The ninth gateway, illuminate your shadow. As an infant, you were pure potential, full and whole, open and authentic, yielding and powerful, good and bad, disciplined and spontaneous, a container of possibilities. In growing up, you disowned parts of your being that conflicted with emerging values. Creating false self-images, you became this, but not that. Hidden opposites will have their day. It's what you don't see that can hurt you. By redeeming your shadow, you become whole again and real. Releasing energy once bound in defense of self-image, you find new energy, understanding, humility, and compassion. Now we come to a place on the path to everyday enlightenment, to the ninth gateway called Illuminate Your Shadow. This is an arena more puzzling and mysterious to many of us than the other gateways. Those of us who studied psychology and Carl Jung, we know something about the shadow, but not exactly what it is or how it manifests in our life or why it's important enough to be one of the 12 gateways. Let's do a brief assessment to help you start to consider this issue of your shadow. If someone offends or criticizes you, do you automatically defend yourself? How many times have you stolen or lied? Are you certain it's only that many? Do you sometimes feel resentful when it seems that you give more than you receive? Do you have some resentments about the mistakes your parents made? Do you do more for your spouse or partner than they do for you? Do you know yourself? Do you have good qualities? Do you also have bad qualities? I'm not using these in a sense of judgments on yourself, but more objectively, positive or negative qualities, ones that are more functional and less functional, kind, unkind, and so on. Name the two or three traits or behaviors of people, of other people, that bother you the most. Is there a part of you that might like to behave that way, at least some of the time? I want to read a quote by a man named Harry Palmer. From the time of the ancient Brahmins of India, through the Greek and Roman civilizations, up to the modern deans of the human potential movement, one doctrine, though worded differently, has remained unchanged. It weaves its way in and out of every spiritual practice, every philosophy, and every self-help program. It is, know thyself. Henry David Thoreau said, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could learn what I had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. Before we can be ourselves, we have to know ourselves. When we were babies, we were whole. Most of us find babies charming, very young children. One reason we find them charming is because they're so authentic. They're real. What you see is what you get. Their emotions are right out there. No pretense, spontaneous, uninhibited. But in the process of growing up and being socialized, we became self-conscious and we developed values, different values, therefore different shadows. There were parts of us that we rejected that we began to disown, cut off from ourselves, and say, that's not me, I'm not like that. The shadow is not the dark side as in Darth Vader. The shadow are simply qualities, behaviors, traits, potentials we have said, that's not part of me. For example, someone who grows up with liberal parents or in a pacifist household, they may grow up saying, I'm only good, moral, and peaceful. These kind of people scare me a little bit. I don't know about you. I'm wondering if next week they're going to be up on a clock tower somewhere sniping. You know, these serial killers, they always look back and they say, you know what, they were always so quiet. Someone who grows up in the inner city, in a gang, their shadow might be, I'm only tough. I'm not vulnerable, sensitive. Because that's weak. So we have different shadows. And in not owning our shadow, not becoming whole, and being partial, this personality that's this but not that, we end up cutting off a lot of our power and our creativity. That's why we want to own our shadow. Because when you begin to see your shadow and know it, you become more human. We become more compassionate, less resentful, and tend to be more grateful. It's not a method for becoming more grateful because we can't control how we feel. But we will tend to be more grateful and less resentful, much more compassionate. We begin to go through life saying, there but for the grace of God go I, instead of look at that jerk. How could they do a thing like that? Becoming whole does not mean acting in every kind of way. If there's a part of you that's sociopathic, as there is me, part of me is ruthless. I've seen that part of my shadow. I'd rather go, no, I'm not ruthless. That's not part of me. But I've seen that part. It doesn't mean I have to act ruthless, but it means I can take that positive germ of ruthlessness, which can be assertiveness, and use that. So, don't be confused thinking when you become whole, you act in all these negative antisocial ways. No, in fact, you're less likely to act that way when you know that's a part of you. You can control it. If I find out there's a part of me that's very aggressive, I can use it in sports, in martial arts, in ping pong, in chess. You can work it out in constructive, positive ways rather than have it just kind of emerge, such as those people, the televangelists we've seen on television, some of them, who said, I'm only moral. I am not a moral, lustful sinner. So they righteously preach on Sunday and go commit all those sins on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And we've read about some of these people. That's an example of being so exaggerated on one side that they deny the other part, and it comes out in ways that don't work very well. I was reading Publishers Weekly the other day, and I noticed an article on an agent. Now, it's the job of an agent to get the best possible advance for the author. And they love auctions. When you have 5 or 6 or 7 publishers all interested in the same book, you can say, well, what's your high bid? And you get a better price for the author and for the agent. What happened was there was an experienced agent known for high integrity who had 3 publishers who were going to bid on a book. She was excited about this auction for the author. And at the last minute, 2 of the publishers dropped and decided they were going to pass. They weren't going to bid on the book. So there was only 1 publisher left. She didn't tell that publisher that the other 2 had dropped. That's unethical. Agents shouldn't do that. Thinking that they were in an auction, they made a higher bid. They offered more money for the book than they normally would have if they knew they were the only publisher. This happens sometimes. The point I'm making here is, in the article she said, when she was caught, by the way, the publisher eventually communicated with the other publishers, found out they hadn't bid, and rejected the book. Said, we're not going to take the book on. But what she said was, and when this got public, what she had done, she said, from a part of me I didn't know existed, I just didn't tell the publisher about the other 2 who had dropped. From a part of me I didn't know existed. That does not absolve her of responsibility for her behavior. But But it kind of explained. It explains what was going on. That was part of her shadow. I'm only honest with high integrity. There was a part of her that was not. If she had known that, she would have accounted for it. This is only one of many examples. Let me give you one closer to home. Have you, and this is a rhetorical question because I know the answer. Have you, at a point in your life, had a relationship difficulty? And during that difficulty, you saw parts of yourself you weren't too crazy about? You just saw part of your shadow. And do you notice, having done that, it makes you a little more human, a little more realistic about yourself? You know yourself better. It's not pleasant. Seeing your shadow goes against maybe your values that you've been taught. You mean there's a part of me that could rob and steal and lie? There's a part of me that's aggressive, that's not nice at all, that can be a jerk? When you've seen that, you go, yep, that is a part of me. I was teaching a seminar in Berkeley once. I gave a lecture and some people were saying why they were there. And one young woman who was sitting there up in the front, she said, I'm here because my boyfriend thinks you're full of crap. And I looked at her and I went, you know, that depends on what time of day you catch me. Point is, I don't offend easily anymore. It's almost impossible to offend me because any name you could call me, I'd say, well, there is a part of me. Yeah, there is. Not because I'm just giving you, you know, a verbal Aikido or saying it because it sounds good, but because I've seen it. I've done enough work on the shadow. Yes, whatever you could call me, whether it's complimentary or not, there's a part of me that could be like that. I have qualities like that. I may not choose to animate them. So now if somebody says, you know, you're a jerk, I go, well, you know, some of the time I can be, but you're a very interesting person. When you start to see your shadow and become whole, you free up immense energy. Talk about energizing your body and your life. It takes a lot of energy to put up this false image we present to the world. Oh, what a nice lady. But she knows she's not always nice, isn't she? One lady I know did a lot of shadow work and she joined a ladies group called Bitches from Hell. She loved it. Because that was a side of her she'd never brought out. You free up energy, you become more compassionate because you've seen those attributes in yourself. So one way to start to see your shadow is through relationship, in the mirror of relationship. Not just with a loved one. Not just through problems and you lose face. You really find face, you don't lose it. You find another face and another and another. We have many faces. Many sides. And that makes us powerful. But also through relationship, people who bother you. Have you been cut off in traffic by somebody? You feel angry, right? Immediately you remember when someone had done that. But do you remember as easily those times you cut someone else off? And be assured you have. We go, oh, that's no big deal. That's the self-image, the self-serving image we've created for ourselves. What angels we are. That's what we need to cut through to come to know ourselves. Sidney J. Harris once wrote, 90% of the world's woes come from people not knowing themselves, their abilities, their frailties, and even their real virtues. Most of us go almost all the way through life as complete strangers to ourselves, believing we know ourselves. Anne Sexton, in about 7 words or 8 words, says it wonderfully. Once I was beautiful, now I am myself. Robert Frost wrote, something we were withholding made us weak until we found out it was ourselves. Carl Jung said, a whole person has walked with God and wrestled with the devil. Hermann Hesse, if you hate a person, you hate something in that person that is a part of yourself. What isn't a part of yourself doesn't disturb you. Let me give an example. From the time our first daughter was born, Joy and I stopped going out. We'd been a couple, we'd gone out for years. Let's go to a movie. Okay, let's go out to dinner. But we didn't trust our kids with any babysitters. We didn't have relatives around. So we didn't go out. That's when I got her first VCR. Point is, 4 years later, you know, our second daughter had been born 2.5 years after our first. 4 years later, we still had not gone out. And I had some friends who were still, you know, childless, and they were young couples just going off to Hawaii, and they said, "Oh, we just got back from Club Med, Dan." And I'm going, kind of, "How nice for you." And I didn't want to admit it, but part of me was really resentful. I looked down on them. I judged them because they were flitting around going to all these places. You can tell I still have a little charge with it. But that's because there was a part of me that wanted to do that. There was a part of me that wanted to do exactly that, be less responsible and just go play. But I couldn't acknowledge that. I was a parent. I was a responsible, good father. I wasn't like those irresponsible people, just running around having fun. That's part of the shadow. I resented it. So find out what troubles you about other people. I was eating dinner with a family once, and I noticed one of the kids just really was bothered by other people eating too fast and not minding their table manners. But I was fascinated to see that same child just kind of shovel the food down and ate really loud with their mouth open. It even happens when young. What troubles you about other people, you can't hate or love anything in anyone else you don't hate or love in yourself. That's another way of coming to know your shadow. Dreams. Dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And Jungian therapists will work with dreams because in dreams, all the characters in the dream are you. Different facets of you. It's one way to understand them. There's no standard way of interpreting dreams and saying this symbol always means this or that. Your sense, your feeling, your instinct about the dream is more important than the images. Some people can have a dream about a monster and it can be a funny dream. They feel funny. Others can have a dream about getting toast out of a toaster and it can feel like a nightmare. The dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. You can start to learn more about the subconscious mind, how it works, and start to see parts of your shadow. If you ever do pay attention and start writing down dreams, you can do it with a sense of what can I learn about myself in this dream. That's the first basis for understanding dreams. What can I learn about myself in these characters? They're all you. Another reason you want to illuminate your shadow is it's essential to doing so in order to progress in the gateways. Because we have sexual shadows as well, which we'll get into. It's very, very difficult to open your heart in an authentic way without having seen yourself as you are. It's hard to have compassion for other people unless you understand them. For example, a woman once got out of a car in the snow and she had crutches, and she was very, very resentful about somebody who had parked directly in front of the way she needed to go through the snow to get to the store, until she saw the person come out and they were severely handicapped. The moment she understood them, she had compassion. But it's hard to understand other people until you understand yourself. So by doing shadow work and starting to look at yourself as you are, to accept yourself as you are, with all your qualities in the area of life and security, we have some people who are team players, others are rebels. Team players, united we stand, divided we fall. The rebel, I can only do it my way. If you want to do something right, you have to do it yourself. In the domain of creativity, we have people who are skillful, who paint by numbers, do all the steps, and we have people who are fantasizers. They just wait for inspiration. In the area of the intellectual domain, we have people who are analytical and some who are more disoriented. Some people like to ask questions, some answer them. In the area of the social domain, we have the social butterfly on the one side and the lone wolf on the other. In the area of work, we have people who are into the workhorse and a lazy bones. People who are chronically relaxed. In the area of hierarchies, we have the peacock and the chicken. In the conduct and morals domain, We have the Puritan and the Hedonist. More about that later when we explore sexuality. And finally, in the spiritual domain, we have the believer and the doubter. Whatever area, wherever you are, especially if you're like 80%, 70 or 80% valuing more one side of those dichotomies than the other, the other part will tend to be in your shadow. You'll go, I'm this way, I'm not that way. But it comes out in many ways. Someone may act sentimental at work or rigid at work and sentimental at home, or vice versa. So these give a map to understand aspects of our shadow. And you see, they're not dark, evil, or bad. They're just different sides of our personality. Can you imagine what would it be like to be able to play those roles like an actor? Sometimes it's appropriate to be rigid and define boundaries and say no. Other times, to be sentimental. Sometimes it's appropriate to act like the peacock, confidence, self-respect. Other times, to act like the chicken, defer to other people. Sometimes it's appropriate to ask questions. Other times, to explain and play the role of teacher. You become a full human being and whole and authentic and powerful and effective and creative when you combine all these different domains. Rather than saying, I'm not this, I'm only this. We become balanced. Powerful shadow area. But now we come to the most effective and little known method for learning about your shadow, for becoming whole and fully human that I know of. It's called the three-question reality check. We've already done the three-question wake-up call, remember? Am I breathing? Am I relaxed? Am I moving with elegance? To bring our attention back to the present moment. Now we do the three-question reality check. You may want to write this down. What you do is you contemplate your relationship with a significant other in your life. Traditionally, this has been done with the mother first, then the father, then perhaps siblings, wife, husband, partner, and others in your life. You take a finite period of time, maybe your first 9 years, or the last 3 months, or the last 3 years, or the first 3 years you knew each other. Any finite period of time. All right? Then, in your relationship to that person, you ask three questions. The first question is, what have I received from X, that person? What have I received? Be very specific. You don't go, I received love and caring. That's abstract. You say, I'll use my wife as an example. My wife made me thousands of meals. She made me my favorite dessert on my birthday. She cleaned my clothes. She was there to support me and give me good advice about my last book when I was going off with it. She gave me the advice to help me keep it on track. You remember specific things you received from that person. It can be difficult to do if you're angry or have a charge with that person, if they're an adversary or someone who hurt you. But you start thinking of what you received. This is a very controversial area, but nobody is a cardboard cutout figure. People are real. They have many dimensions. A man who abused a child, who sexually molested a child, it's a villainous, terrible thing to do. But that same man might have taken that child to a movie, bought an ice cream cone, befriended the child, said kind things. It doesn't minimize or negate the negative things that person did. Is that clear? But the person is not only bad, a villain. They may have done some nice things as well. We start seeing others more realistically. Not better or worse, but realistically. So we say, what did I receive from that person? Second, what did I give to that person? Again, very specific. Not, I gave them this, or I gave them that, or I made money and gave it to them. Very specifically, what did you give them? For birthdays, for anniversaries, for gifts, what services did you provide? Very specifically. By the way, don't count those things that were also self-serving. In other words, if you also benefited from what you gave them, it wasn't really just giving to them. Also, let me jump back. What they gave you, it doesn't matter whether it was their job or responsibility. If there were a parent that changed your diapers, you don't go, oh, well, that doesn't count because it was their job. After all, they're my parent. Doesn't matter whether it was their responsibility or not. They did it for you. The third and most important question in the three-question reality check is, what troubles or difficulties did I cause that person? You want to spend 60% of your time on that question. There is no fourth question, but we'd be really good at the fourth question, wouldn't we be? What difficulties or troubles did they cause us? Easy. We can make a list. We're already good at that. We're not so good at thinking about the troubles or difficulties or inconvenience we caused them. The time our parents stayed up with us all night when we were sick. The time they drove us back and forth and back and forth and back and forth when we were teenagers. The unkind words we said to them. It goes on and on. Very important, the third part of this question, for starting to see your shadow side. Now, I personally went to a retreat. It's in Japan, it's called Nikan, N-A-I-K-A-N. Nikan is the reflective aspect. Think about this. Marita taught, accept your feelings, know your purpose, and do what needs to be done. How does that work for an assassin? They may feel bad about it, but they accept their feelings, know their purpose, and do what needs to be done. So action without self-reflection can lead us astray. The Nikon aspect, the reflective aspect of constructive living, let's say, is the moral aspect. It's seeing ourselves realistically. Now, you may say, gosh, isn't this going to lower my self-esteem, seeing how I've caused all these people troubles and difficulties? Won't it lower my self-worth? You know what? It may for a while. But it will raise your esteem for reality. And we have to take another look at self-worth regarding this shadow element. I went to a Nikon retreat and I spent 16 hours a day from dawn to after dark sitting behind a screen, staring at a wall, reflecting on my mother, my father, and others in my life every single year of my 52 years so far. What I received, what I gave, what difficulties or troubles I caused them. And after it was over, I felt I had changed in a way nothing had ever changed me before. I said, you know, when good things happen to me, I used to wonder if I deserved it. I said, it's such a relief to know I didn't. But wait a minute, how does this affect our self-worth if we feel we don't deserve life's gifts? Now we make a jump in our understanding. We don't have to deserve them. That's the meaning of grace. Life showers gifts down. The chair you may be sitting in right now is supporting you, whether you're a real nice person or not. The sunshine keeps shining down upon you. The rain waters the flowers around your house. Life keeps giving gifts, and we can accept them because they're life's gifts, whether or not we happen to feel we deserve them. Without looking and doing the shadow work, we go through life casual, self-righteous, and resentful of all that life isn't giving us. Resentful of our parents, resentful of people in our lives, our spouse. One of the best things you can do for your relationship when you're having difficulties is to sit down by yourself and take 3 minutes and write down quickly for that day or 2 days or the last week what you received from this person, what you gave to them, which usually is a lot less than you received, and what troubles or difficulties you caused them. This can heal relationships in a way nothing else can. The three-question reality check. You're not going to be motivated to do it. I wasn't motivated to sit 16 hours a day for a week and contemplate all the troubles and difficulties I'd caused everyone I'd ever loved. Brought stuff up in my past I'd forgotten and glossed over. But I'm a better teacher and a better person because of it. You'll have to experience it for yourself. Having done the three-question reality check with more than one person, with two or three or four, as you develop some skill in focusing in on what you've received from someone, what you've given, and the troubles or difficulties you've caused, you come to realize and appreciate that your business in the world is not so much forgiving others. This has become very fashionable. Many books talk about how it's important to forgive other people. You find out your first order of business is not forgiving other people. It's asking others' forgiveness. Big difference. Some people go around almost self-righteously saying, I'm going to forgive that person of their transgressions. I'm going to forgive them for their transgressions against me. Oh, and what they did against me, I'll forgive them too. No, our business is to ask forgiveness. I ask my daughters forgiveness a lot. When they're little, I'll say something or not be home when they need me for something sometimes. And you know what? If you ask someone for their forgiveness and they refuse, then you can forgive them for not forgiving you. Mother Teresa once said, I had to look at my Hitler side before I could experience my Christ side. Carl Jung said, you meet yourself in 1,000 disguises on the path of life. Albert Einstein once wrote, 100 times a day I remind myself that my inner and outer life depends on the labors of others, living and dead, and that I must exert myself in order to give in the measure as I have received and am still receiving. And I end the 9th gateway, illuminate your shadow, with the words of David Reynolds. When I focus on getting my share, I'll always be disappointed. But by noticing what I'm already receiving and then working to repay those around me, I find a genuine opportunity for fulfillment. You're going to grow into a new place as I'm still growing, as you illuminate your shadow. See and accept yourself as you are, and you come to accept others as they are. The 10th gateway, embrace your sexuality. Hungers and appetites for sexual release, for food, for life, are as natural to you as clouds are to the sky or waves to the sea. If you suppress or exploit the surging power of your drives, you create obsessions, compulsions, and guilty secrets. Life is not a matter of indulging or denying the energies of life, but observing, accepting, and wisely channeling them. Embracing your sexuality. By embracing your sexuality, you celebrate your humanity. Now we turn to the 10th gateway. Embrace your sexuality. Let's begin by considering some self-assessment type of questions in the realm of sexuality. What sexual issues, fantasies, desires, or concerns haven't you shared with your spouse or partner? Why? Do you sometimes have sexual fantasies about someone of the same gender? Does this seem problematic to you? Have you ever wondered or worried that you might not be, quote, male enough or, quote, unquote, female enough? Would you describe yourself sexually as more puritanical or more hedonistic? In other words, do you go with the rules or with your impulses? Is one approach better than the other? Why? Might your spouse or partner prefer you to be different sexually? Might you prefer your spouse or partner to be different sexually? Have you communicated this Are these differences more physical, emotional, or mental? How might you make your sexual life more fulfilling? Take a fresh look. Are you exclusively heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual? Did you determine this on the basis of experience or fantasies and feelings? Do you have sexual guilt or shame? In what area or areas? Do you have a greater or lesser desire for orgasm than your spouse or partner? Do you masturbate? Why or why not? Have you ever been sexually intimate with someone else while you were married? What did you learn from this? Have you been sexually intimate with someone who was married at the time? What did you learn from this? Sexuality is a primal human drive. This is apparent to most of us, but we pretend it's not. We go around button-down collar, fully clothed, and pretend there's no sex. Except in the movies, in the magazines, and everywhere we look, we project it out everywhere. If you watch the soap operas, you think everybody's having sex with everybody. It's amazing what teens see on TV now. What role modeling? Another mammal, with some similarities to the human being, the rat, was studied in a unique study of values and priorities. And what they did, what the scientists did, were they put an electrode, a sensor, or an electrode into the pleasure center, the sexual pleasure center of the rat's brain. And then they had one lever. If the rat pushed one lever, it got a pellet of food. And if it pushed another lever, it got the pleasure center stimulated. So it had a choice. And those rats were starving to death. Now, we all know Sigmund Freud said we have to sublimate our sexual drives and desires. Many of us have passed by the sublimation part and just gone straight to repression. Embracing your sexuality has nothing to do with having more sex or less sex. Nothing. It has nothing to do with exploiting your sexuality and indulging it. And it has nothing to do with denying it or repressing it. Many people misunderstand. They think, oh, Dan's saying, be more sexual. No. Embracing your sexuality is about embracing who you are. Honoring yourself. Your own unique approach to sexuality. As long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. Doesn't matter what fantasies you have, or what behaviors you do, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. And yet, it's about channeling our sexual creative energy in a way that's fully human, that's more pleasurable, more intimate, more fulfilling. Most of us have mixed feelings about sexuality, just as we have mixed feelings about money, especially related to spiritual life. Just like we don't picture spiritual people as having lots and lots of money, we certainly don't picture them as having lots and lots of great sex. Many of us wonder, you know, we start to regard, well, let's see, I want to become more spiritual. Now, does that mean I need to read the books on Tantra yoga and extended sexual orgasm, or maybe I should become celibate? We're not really sure, so we alternate between the two. There's a story I once heard about a pope who died and went to heaven. And St. Peter said, you were the best pope we ever had. You name it. One request, you've got it. And the Pope said, I want to talk to God. And St. Peter said, sure, second door on the left. So the Pope went in there and he came out. Tears were coming down his cheeks. He was crying. St. Peter said, what's the matter? And the Pope said, oh, I made a big mistake. The word was celebrate. Now, there are people who study with Taoist masters. Some, you know, they study celibacy. And they go, well, you know, maybe that's really because then you generate all this sexual energy, the kundalini up your spine, and you hold that energy and you become more creative and spiritual and godlike. You get away from the lower drives, the animalistic drives. But I've noticed that most of the books on celibacy are written by old men. Have you noticed that? What I'm trying to be here is realistic. There is such a thing as motiveless celibacy. How that manifests is, and a person may engage in intimacy, hugging, touching, even sexual relations. But the person is motivelessly celibate. The energies are so balanced in their body that they have no need for orgasm. It doesn't mean they avoid contact. They can be loving, intimate, touching, holding, and express that, but they have no need for orgasm. That is pretty rare in most of our experience. It's different from repressing it or being blocked or being too tired. Embracing your sexuality, as I said, is embracing who you are. We imagine we're sexually sophisticated, don't we? I mean, gee, we've read the books. Today's world, we talk about it, you know, it's more open on the radio, they talk about various things. But we're really not very sophisticated about sexuality as a culture. Look at Dr. Jocelyn Elders, the Surgeon General of the United States, who, in trying to be realistic, suggested perhaps that young people who are not going to practically abstain, that would be best. And most of us agree, it's probably best for young people to abstain from sexuality. But many of them don't, as you may be aware. So she suggested it might be better for them, rather than get into situations that create maybe venereal disease of various kinds, including AIDS, and also pregnancy. And then the question of abortion or not, all this mess. She suggested perhaps it'd be better if they would masturbate. It was bye-bye, Dr. Jocelyn Elders. She was gone, like practically the next day. And we think we're so sophisticated and so practical and open about sexuality. Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, whatever our views are years later of the effectiveness of his presidency, was one of the most moral, good men we've ever had in the presidency. And yet one day he looked at his shadow side and he confessed that he had lust in his heart. Raise your hand if you've had lust in your heart. And yet, he never regained full credibility. It was a laughingstock. People made fun of him from then on. Nope, we're not that sophisticated. Why do we have embrace your sexuality as one of the gateways? Because it is a central area of problems for most of us. No matter what we know, let me ask you, do you have an uninhibited, spontaneous, truly intimate, loving sexual relationship? Well, some you may, if you've known each other more than 2 years, we should say. But many of us, it becomes problematic. It's a symptomatic thing. If we're not getting along, then it changes. If we're getting along, most people don't. So it's an area that still traps our attention. We either want sexuality if we don't have it, or we wonder if we should be fantasizing this, or masturbating, or not, or who we should be having sex with, when, or what's appropriate and what's not. It's a lot around sexuality. That's not just open, natural, normal part of life. So it traps our attention. It's one of those areas that needs to be transcended, understood and resolved as a natural human function. You know, it's always seemed to me crazy, since we all are sexual beings, in some way, unique to us, we express ourselves sexually. And it's always seemed nuts why some people are so concerned of whether a person chooses to have sex with someone of the opposite gender, or the same gender, or a cantaloupe. Don't we have more important things to be dealing with and thinking about in life than this? Minding someone else's sexual expression? A spiritual master I know once expressed the opinion that homosexual relationships are no more degenerate than a lot of heterosexual relationships. So the question is not whether you're bisexual, homosexual, heterosexual, or quadrisexual. You know what quadrisexual is, perhaps. That's someone who will have sex with anyone, anytime, any place for a quarter. The point is, are we connected at the heart? Is it an intimate, responsible relationship, a committed relationship? That's the question, not our style. Many of us are like the preacher. Every time he was making love to his wife, he thought of praying. And every time he was praying, he thought of making love to his wife. Never fully did anything. Should I be doing this? Shouldn't I? There's the old Puritan-hedonist dilemma. Remember, one of those polarities was the Puritan and the hedonist? We get stuck in this thing. Some of us tend to be more Puritans. See, embracing your sexuality is embracing pleasure in life. Some of us feel funny about embracing pleasure. It becomes guilty pleasure. Whether it's really enjoying some chocolate or whatever. So we need to explore this Puritan hedonist dilemma. You know what a Puritan is? That's somebody who stays up at night worrying that somewhere somebody is having a good time. Whereas one hedonist friend I know said, you know, if you give up sex and give up meat and sugar and alcohol and tobacco, and you don't necessarily live longer, it just feels like it. And it's not better to be Puritan or hedonist. There are times it's better to be somewhat hedonistic, isn't it? Who wants to take a Puritan to a party, right? But that doesn't mean you have to go to a party and drink and smoke and do a bunch of things that you really, you know, don't value or aren't good for your health. But some people, it's like, feels like a raving hedonist to them. They're so Puritan, just to dance a little bit and have a little refined sugar. So it's about finding a balance. Sometimes we want to let loose and be hedonistic and go with our impulses. And other times we want to tighten it up and, you know, exercise more, take our vitamins, and be more Puritan, go with the rules. So, again, both are important in the sexual arena, in the arena of life and pleasure. And in fact, it's not even so important whether you tend to be hedonist or Puritan, it's whether you're healthy or not. There are healthy hedonists and unhealthy hedonists. There are healthy Puritans and unhealthy Puritans. Some hedonists indulge themselves so much, they're just totally promiscuous, eat, drink anything, and they hurt their health. They may even kill themselves. Often this is self-destructive, low self-worth hedonism. There are also hedonists who just are fun to be around. They're kind of Italian, you know? They're expressive. They're out there. They drink. They eat. They be merry, you know? For tomorrow we may die. So they live a passionate life, like Zorba the Greek. There are Puritans who are unhealthy Puritans, who never allow themselves any pleasure, feel guilty about anything that's fun. They judge other people by these standards. You know, if it's pleasurable, it's bad. And there are also healthy Puritans who are disciplined, who get up early, the early bird gets the worm, who work hard, who go with the rules and allow themselves pleasure at the appropriate time. That's still Puritan, but it's more healthy. And they get a lot done. Samuel Butler wrote, "All the animals excepting man," and he meant men or women, "know that the principal business of life is to enjoy it." J.D. Salinger, through, I guess it was one of his characters, I forget who the name, but you'll know, Catcher in the Rye, said, "Sex is something I really don't understand. I keep making up these sex rules for myself, and then I break them right away." Maybe that sounds familiar? St. Augustine allegedly once said, "Lord, make me chaste, but just not yet."
I want to tell you a story. It's not altogether frivolous when I joke about whether somebody's homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, whatever. See, potentially everybody can express themselves and touch and play with someone of any gender. Potentially we can do that. We're physically capable of feeling pleasure. I'm not saying people ought to or are all bisexual, because they're not. People have different polarities. We can all fantasize about the same sex sometimes. It's exciting at times. And in a way, it's narcissistic at times. It's like our own body is pleasure. But the thing is, it can be sad at times when people feel the shame and the guilt and society's burdens by puritanical people in the name of religion or anything else who condemn them and justify it with the Bible. You can justify anything with the Bible, high or low. It's all in there. It's a matter of interpretation. People of different states of consciousness read the Bible, they read an entirely different book. I had a friend named Rich. I used to go to Santa Monica Beach. All the gymnasts went there, and we did flips off the rings and worked out on Sundays. It was a very wholesome place, great place to be. And Rich was an amazing guy. He was one of the strongest rings performer, you know, doing the iron crosses and upside down iron crosses and all these amazing moves. He was so strong. His body looked like a Greek god. Picture David, the statue. I mean, amazing chiseled physique. He could do moves that took more strength than anybody I'd ever seen in my life. I'd never seen anybody in the world who could do what he could do. Amazing guy. Not only that, but he would come with books on Korsipsky and general semantics. He was brilliant. He was about 15, 16, 17 years old. And I was younger. I looked up to him. I mean, he played eight old elderly gentlemen on chess, and he beat all of them at chess. He was brilliant. He was handsome. He was like a role model for me. Just admired him so much. And one day I came to the beach and said, "Hi guys," you know, saw the regulars. I said, "Where's Rich?" They said, "Haven't you heard? He killed himself." I went, "What? Not Rich?" It turned out Rich was gay, and he was having an affair with his English teacher, and somebody had found out. What a waste. What a crazy, crazy waste. I feel sad and enraged whenever I think of that. Restimulating feelings. Maybe that's why E.E. Cummings wrote, "To be yourself in a world which does its best to make you someone else means fighting the hardest battle any human being can fight and never stop fighting." Some of us have concerns about whether we're male enough or female enough. The exaggerated male-female thing is best characterized by Japan maybe 20 years ago, where the women walked like this, little mincing steps, you recall? The geisha, they were all service, and they'd go, tee-hee-hee-hee-hee, you know, when they laughed, covered their mouth, and the ultimate little girl femininity. That was supposed to be the ultimate feminine. Whereas in our culture, the ultimate feminine is what? No waist, this voluptuous, you know, this. That's supposed to be ultimate feminine and soft and vulnerable. It's this exaggeration. Of course, the guys in Japan, they were the macho samurai. Yosh! You know, these kind of things. Drinking sake every night. And it was exaggerated. So many people want to be exaggerated to picture John Wayne as the ultimate male. And somebody else, I don't know, who is the ultimate female. It's crazy. It's part of our society. If you have any doubts whether you're male or female, look in your pants. If you need a reminder, that's going to give you a good hint. And the rest is up for grabs, so to speak. Point is, there's no one way for men to act. There's no one way for females to act. You're a man if you're a man. You're a woman if you're a woman. If you're a gay man, you're still a man. If you're a gay woman, you're still a woman. We are who we are, and the rest, you can act any way you want. There's a huge range. So I think we need to just look at deeper issues. You know, the things we have in common with people. We want to be appreciated and loved and cared for. And we want to care about other people. We want to do meaningful work. Those things seem more important than getting wrapped up in all this sexual stuff. It's a small point. If somebody ever comes out and says, "I'm gay," it may be important for them to just acknowledge what they had hidden. A secret might have been shameful. But I go, "Oh, that's nice. Now, how you doing?" You know, I mean, it's not a big deal. Gay isn't beautiful. It's not ugly. It's no different from anybody else. It's just what it is. On the other hand, This war between the sexes, between men and women, is a reflection of the war between our inner male and female. And that's not new. Carl Jung talked about the animus and the anima. Every male has an anima, a female side, whether it's that side that's tender, nourishing, receptive, classically associated with females. And every female has a male side, classically associated with males, the kind of the inner warrior, tough, committed, you know, strong. And part of our growth and evolution is to become more androgynous in the sense that males take on the qualities of females and they're more balanced. They're whole human beings. And females take on those qualities of males as well as their own female qualities. So they become strong and forthright. That's starting to happen, but it causes some turmoil and imbalance. Because some men don't feel masculine enough. If the woman in their life is also very strong and forthright and refuses to ask for direction. The point is, many men are insecure about that, knowing their wife could beat them up. What do they got? What do we got left, guys? We already think the women are smarter, right? We have to stop this thing of this is male territory, this is female territory, and start having separate but private cultures, separate but interactive cultures. I believe there should be clubs that only allow women, and there should also be clubs that only allow men. And then when they want to, they can go to a co-ed club and come together. I think we're evolving toward that. It's gone backwards, swung back and forth, the pendulum. So this issue of male and female, this war inside of us, men who don't like women reject the female part of themselves. They're afraid of it. Women who resent men reject the male part of themselves. That's not a strict formula, but it's a tendency. Once we embrace that and we become whole, we've got no more war or problems with the opposite gender. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus was said to have stated, "When you make the two one, and when you make the outside like the inside, and above like below, when you make the male and the female as one, then you will enter the kingdom of God." That's what he was talking about, taking on all the aspects, male and female, in each one of us. I can be tender, receptive, soft, sensitive, a sensitive New Age guy. But I can also be pretty tough. Women are the same way. They can be soft, sensitive, but they can also be pretty tough and very strong. How many men have given birth, huh? But some women think becoming balanced and equal is being acting like a man traditionally. So they become only tough. And they lose their sensitive, nourishing side sometimes. Someone once said, "If a woman wants to act like a man, why can't she act like a nice man?" Sexuality can be applied in terms of Tantra yoga, but it doesn't have to be formally a spiritual discipline. Any truly intimate, loving, open, ecstatic sexual union is a spiritual enterprise. Two people letting go of their armors and just letting go. That is a sexual practice. It doesn't have to be within certain breathing practices. You can do those too. And concentration practices. In fact, E.L. Watkins said, "Mysticism is not disguised sex. Sex is disguised mysticism." I'd like to tell you about a radical sexual experiment which took place in not one but two different spiritual communities at different times. The reason it's unique and the reason it's important that it took place in spiritual communities is because the priority of these communities was the bigger picture of life, transcendence, and spirituality. And yet they were kind of wild spiritual communities at times. I won't name the teachers. The fact that they had a guru, a teacher, who was recognized by the followers, by the disciples, as a master, those masters made the rules. It was a society unto itself. And in each, I'll just tell about one of them because they're very similar. One of these masters one day said, "We're going to take on a consideration about sexuality." And there were about 300 people in the community who used to spend time in the ashram, the sanctuary. He said, "All sexual rules are now off. Anything you ever learned, all marriages are suspended." Now, you don't usually have that happen in society, but in this community it did. He said, "Do whatever you want to do, explore every kind of sexuality you can. Men who weren't even homosexuals were having sex with other men, seeing what that was like. Women were doing the same. There were twosomes and threesomes and wife swapping and husband swapping and groups living together and every kind of promiscuity. By the way, they were all checked health-wise. They used precautions. It wasn't crazy or self-destructive. But, as you might imagine, it created a lot of personal turmoil. People couldn't just pretend, oh, this is okay, because he said it was. Jealousies, resentments, insecurities, all of it was brought up. And it was talked and processed into the night, every night. It went on for months, like a whole summer almost. At the end of this time, everything settled back down. Some marriages broke up. Others got back together. He said, all this is off. Now we're back to normal, status quo. Let's consider what happened. And after all this ended, the conclusion that not the spiritual master didn't tell them this is how it is, they all considered it. And the consensus was that sexuality, in terms of spiritual practice, works best in a committed, intimate relationship. The rest, because again, about freeing our attention, you have a mate. We need mates. Most of us do, unless we exclusively masturbate, which some people do if they don't have a partner. But otherwise, we need a mate. If we have a mate, it works better to have one stable family. Not just for the raising of children, of course. But we have a stable thing, so we don't have to be looking around. Who's that? Where's my next conquest? There's my next mate. I need to express with somebody, you know. We don't have to do that. So our attention is free then for the higher elements of life as well. So that was the conclusion. And it didn't matter whether it was a committed heterosexual or committed homosexual relationship, as long as it was a committed, intimate relationship. What about masturbation anyway? We've all been told it's okay, it's natural. We've also been told it's not okay and natural. And the Bible's been quoted, and other sources have been quoted, and scientific studies have been quoted, and Taoist masters will tell you you don't want to waste the vital jing, the fluid, the energy. Whatever opinions or philosophies or beliefs or religious mores we have, fact is, lots of people masturbate, whether they're married or not. And I'm going to suggest to you that if someone is single, they don't have a mate, or they have a mate but they're away for an extended period of time, masturbation, if they need sexual release, seems one good solution, practical solution, if you compare it to going to a bar or picking up somebody and getting into very kinky situations. Seems a relatively benign solution. Also, in a married couple, it happens sometimes that an otherwise compatible couple that love each other, one of them has a far greater need for sex, and it may be the male, it may be the female. So it may be a solution for the person who needs more orgasms at that point in their life to masturbate more, and when the other person develops, builds up their sexual, their drive and their need for orgasm, then they come together. I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but I'm just proposing it as a sane approach to relationships. Many people, that isn't talked about. That isn't talked about. How many of you talk about masturbation with your spouse? Let me give you the germ of Tantra Yoga in a nutshell. Consciously connect your genitals to your heart. That's it. Oh yeah, just pure objective sex can feel good. When it's good, it's really good. When it's bad, it's still not too bad. You know? But by consciously becoming aware of your heart, as well as your genitals when you're having sex, it brings in a different element to the intimacy. It may be good advice to suggest that it's best to come together with someone sexually when you feel both love and desire. That it's optimal sexual intimacy when you feel both love and desire. There are people who come together lots with lots of desire, but there's not much love there. That's what eroticism is. Desire, not necessarily love. That may be less fulfilling in the long run than love and desire. There are also other people who come together with lots of love, but they don't really have too much desire. That may not be the best time to have sex. Optimally, when you both feel those moments of love and desire. My wife and I don't have sex lots. We only do when we really are both into it. And so when we do, it's good. How many of you feel a subtle pressure in your relationship, whether you're male or female? It happens to both. Okay, I guess my spouse wants to have sex now, so I will, even though I don't really feel like it right now. Maybe you shouldn't. But now, let me argue the opposite. The second gateway, reclaim your will, can be applied to the realm of sexuality. There, you know, mostly when you think of applying your will to sexuality, aren't you thinking of not having something, not doing it, not having pleasure, not masturbating, and so on? But actually, you can apply will also to have sexuality. But there may be some times when you're not particularly in the mood for sex, but your spouse or partner would really like to have sex. Maybe they need the touch, the intimacy, whatever it means to them, or just want to have a release. And in those times, you can apply your will that even if you're not really in the mood, you can offer it as a gift, as a form of healing to your partner. And you know what? You end up getting in the mood. So you don't have to always be in the mood to have sex. Remember, we've been talking quite a bit about the consideration of what you can and cannot control, that you're not responsible for feelings or thoughts, only for behavior. I was doing a book signing, I think it was in Los Angeles, maybe San Francisco, some years ago. No, it was L.A. And at the end of the book signing, most everybody had gone. There was one few people who hung out at the end. And one very attractive young woman in her mid-20s came up to me. You really noticeably very attractive. And she came up and she said, "I love your work and I just love you." And she said, "I understand you're staying over tonight. Would you like to stay at my place? Would you like to sleep with me? Spend the night with me?" Well, I answered her honestly. "You bet I would. But I'm not going to. Do you understand?" I was being quite honest with her. She's very attractive. It probably would have been lots of fun and very pleasurable. We were given nerve endings for a reason. So yes, the answer honestly was, "Oh, I'd love to do that. But I'm not going to. Not a chance. I'm married." Made a commitment. If we could write down all our sexual fantasies, we'd probably have a best-selling book. Let me see a show of hands if you've had some interesting sexual fantasies that you'd rather not share publicly. Well, then we won't. In fact, we now close that gateway for now with those considerations about embracing your sexuality, the 10th gateway, which opens the way for the 11th gateway, awakening your heart.